He's such a doll. Hi, everybody. I'm Linda. I'm an alcoholic addict.
Hi, Linda.
Can you hear my heart beating outside my chest? I'm a little nervous. I'm very grateful to be here clean and sober today. My life, honestly, is 1,000 times better than I ever, ever imagined it could be as a result of this program. Thank you for asking me, Tim and Wisconsin Area Convention Committee. Thank you for having me come out. I'm honored. It is an honor to be up here. I'm very humbled by that you had asked me to be here to speak tonight. And it took me a long time to get here. But I have a few notes so that I can stay on track, because I tend to get nervous and I lose track of what I'm going to say. When I first walked into a CA meeting, I knew I belonged. I knew I fit right in, my very first CA meeting. I had gone to AA prior many years ago, and there was just something missing. And when the meeting first started, when the gentleman first came up to the podium, and everybody was cheering, like, yeah, the kickoff meeting. It's such an awesome energy and excitement in this room. And it's just such a great feeling to be a part of this. You know, life is exciting today. Life is amazing today. It's wonderful. It does have its ups and downs, but I'll tell you what, I have more joys in my life today than anything else. And I was taught to, you know, no matter what's going on in your life, how negative it could be, there's always a blessing to be seen in any situation, in every situation, and I've learned how to do that. And sometimes are easier than others, you know. But how I got here, I was brought up in an Irish Catholic family. My father was a police officer, and I came from a good home. I had a very good upbringing. There were always rules to follow, and I was usually grounded because I was such a rebel. I was a rule breaker from a very young age. I was always pushing, you know. My curfew was at 10 o'clock. My mom was like, I swear you waited outside until 10:02 to come in the house. So I went to Catholic schools and learned all about God in Catholic schools, and I had a very good upbringing. I didn't have an alcoholic home situation. My parents really didn't drink. My father worked a lot. He was gone a lot. He, besides being a police officer, he had a couple other jobs. He did security. He was a butcher. He did all kinds of things. And he was always working to support the family and give us everything that he could, because he didn't have that when he was growing up. So by the time I was 13, eighth grade, I was hanging out with the football team. I was a cheerleader, and somebody's parents went out for the night, and we were having a party in the basement, and everybody was drinking. And so I had my first drink when I was 13, and I honestly liked it right away. I liked the buzz. I felt like I was funny. I was a lot more social. So by the time I was 15, I was hanging out on the park bench with all the potheads and the burnout, smoking pot. Through high school, I did a little bit of speed early on. And then my senior year of high school, I became pregnant. And I went to all-girls Catholic high school, so it didn't go over very well. So I had to hide it. I hid it from my parents for about 4 months. I knew immediately when I was pregnant that I wanted to have this baby, and I pretty much knew I was going to be a single parent, and I was fine with that. I was okay with that. Thank you. Yeah. So I hid it from my parents because I was, one, terrified to tell them, and I remember when I was 4 months pregnant, I told my mom as I was running out the door to go to work. I was working at Jewel at the time. I was a cashier, and my father wasn't at home yet. He was at work. So I just said something really quick, like, by the way, I'm pregnant and I'm going to be late for work. So she was probably like, what? So I said, you know, she's like, you know, we'll talk about it later when your father gets home. And when I was growing up, it was always like, wait till your father gets home. Just wait till your father gets home. And I would be terrified. You know, my dad wasn't physical with us, but I knew, you know, he would get up in your face yelling like this. He was very intimidating, but he was also very loving and affectionate. So he was the authoritative figure, pretty much. So I was terrified. And I was always daddy's little girl, you know. And so I came home around dinner time. We were sitting at the dinner table, and my mom must have said something to him prior, because the next thing he said was, so I hear I'm going to be a grandpa. And I said, uh-huh. And he said, so when's the wedding? And I literally ran to my room, and I was just crying, because I thought, I just felt like the biggest disappointment. Like, I so let them down, you know. And it meant a lot to me that, you know, I was, you know, that, not that they looked up to me, but they approved of me and, you know, loved me for, you know, that I wasn't a disappointment. So, you know, self-approval. And so things smoothed out, and I had to hide it from my high school, like I said, and I was going to high school with my books in front of me so nobody could tell, and I had this Catholic girls' school outfit on, the skirt, and I had my blouse untucked, and the bigger I got, I actually kind of stayed small because I was only 100 pounds when I got pregnant. I was tiny, but there were times I had to get up in front of the class and give a report, and I would just take the F because I didn't want anybody to know. I wanted to try and stay in school. So finally one day, the counselor called me to the office, and she's like, stand up. So I stood up. She's like, tuck in your blouse. And I did, and she said, well, I know you're at least 3 months pregnant. And I was 7 months pregnant at the time, so I did hide it very well. And so I didn't admit to anything. My parents got called. My parents, of course, already knew the situation. And the thing was that you can't go to the Catholic Girls High School and be pregnant. You cannot stay in school, you know. There were other high schools that would have taken me. I had 8 weeks before I was going to graduate, before I was kicked out. I was graduating in May, and the baby was due in July. So I took correspondence through the mail. I did my schoolwork the last 8 weeks. I was not allowed to graduate on stage. They told me I was a bad influence. I got pulled into the principal's office, and she was a nun. And she said that, you know, I was a bad influence on the other students. So that didn't make me feel very good about myself either. Again, felt like a little bit of a disappointment. You know, I let people down. And so I did correspondence, and I graduated. I went to the office the same day everybody graduated to pick up my diploma, and I did get a diploma from Resurrection Girls High School, which I was pretty excited about. Because at the time I was, and I was not a really good student. I was always getting D's. I was in summer school every year. But this time I was like, I'm going to show you. And I actually graduated with B's. And I really don't know how I did it. I was just had this determination like, oh yeah, I'm going to show you. And I got my diploma. So meanwhile, while I was pregnant, I, like I said, I was working at Jewel, and I was cashiering, and, you know, the father wasn't around, and I honestly have always had a boyfriend since the time I was 8. I don't know, I just was always seeking outside myself. I was very codependent, I was very insecure, and I was just always searching for that love, and the attention, the affection, the approval, always, you know. And honestly, my first boyfriend, I was 8 years old, and his name was Freddie. And I remember we were walking down the alley one day, and he had a pack of Cools, and he's like, do you want a cigarette? Because he smoked. And I was like, sure. So that was my first cigarette. I was 8. So I started dating this guy that worked at Jewel, and he didn't seem to mind that I was pregnant. So we continued on, and the whole time I was pregnant, I would go over and visit him. He had his own apartment, and I knew that, you know, he smoked pot and stuff. And but every time I went over to visit him, he had, you know, he was doing lines of cocaine, and he had his face in the mirror. And I had never tried cocaine yet, and I was just kept thinking, like, this must be some really good shit because he's not paying attention to me, you know? Like, it always had to be, like, me. I had to be center attention in the spotlight, you know. What about me? Pay attention to me. Look at me, you know. which is part of the reason why I'm nervous up here today, because today, years later, I don't want to be in the spotlight. I don't want to be in the spotlight. I'd rather be in the back row right now. But I am grateful to be up here sharing my experience. So 2 weeks after I had a healthy baby boy, it was the happiest day in my life. My mother was in the delivery room with me, and I just remember them handing it to me, and I was just crying. I was so happy, and I just felt a love that I had never, ever felt before, you know? And it was incredible, and anybody who's a mom knows that love, you know, and it's a totally different love than anything I could ever explain. And I remember when I was pregnant saying, you know, I really want a boy, because I know that's going to be one man that's always going to love me and never going to leave me. I had this thought, you know, and it's just crazy that I would be thinking that way at 17, you know. But so I had a healthy baby boy. And 2 weeks after he was born, went back to the boyfriend's house, and I did my first line of cocaine. And honestly, I was in love. I loved speed in high school, and I just loved the feeling, and I was able to drink more, because by this time, I was a hardcore alcoholic before I ever touched cocaine. You know, I would just drink, binge drink. And so that was my first experience with cocaine, and then we all know how it builds up, and it took off, and I was living at home with my parents. They said whatever, you know, they'd help me in any way they can, and they'd support me. And so I was a single mom living at home with my parents, and I'm just a kid, and you know, trying to do the right thing. And at the time, while I was pregnant, and while my son was being born, my grandmother, who I was very, very close with, was dying of cancer. And she was living with us. We were taking care of her. And we had a hospital bed set up in the living room for her. And I kind of watched her wilt away. And it was very painful. And she, like I said, she was my everything. I think I was closer to my grandmother than I was to my mom when I was that young, because, you know, you don't tell your mom everything, but anything, and she would never judge me. And it was safe, you know, I felt safe with her telling her stuff. So she died 2 months after my son was born in our living room, and I was just really off to the races. Like, I couldn't, I just was kept stuffing that pain, you know, and I didn't know how else to cope, you know. So the drug using escalated, and I was just snorting lines for several years after that. And I got involved in another bunch of relationships on and off, and I was always with the drug dealers, and I was always in these physically and verbally and mentally abusive relationships. I got involved in this 4-year relationship that was very, very abusive. And, you know, I didn't stay because I loved him. I loved the cocaine, you know, and I knew if I left that situation, I knew what I had to go back to. And at this point, my parents became the authority figure in my son's life. They're like, they kicked me out so many times. They're like, you go do whatever you're going to do, and you leave Danny here. And it made sense to me. I loved him enough to not drag him out on the street with me. I wanted him to have, you know, a happy, healthy, stable life. So it made sense to me. You know, I loved him enough to, you know, say yes, like, I will leave him here, you know, and I will do what I had to do. So anyways, I finally got out of this 4-year relationship, and I got really tired of my parents saying, you know, you got a problem, go get help, you got a problem, go get help. And just to get everybody off my back, I went to a treatment center. And of course, I lied on the evaluation, like we all do. I wasn't going to tell how much I was using, because I didn't think I belonged there. And I wasn't going to be locked up, because I had to be in control. So I did an outpatient program. And I was good for about 30 days. I went at night. I had a day job. Somebody hooked me up with a job from the treatment center. Another alcoholic. And I just remember thinking, at the time I was 24, and I just remember thinking, like, you know, I'm 24, I don't belong here. Like, I'm, you know, life is, I'm supposed to be out partying right now and having a good time. I'm only 24. And the people in my group, in this program, this outpatient program, were like older. At the time, older to me was 40, which isn't that old, but they were older, and I just couldn't relate, and they were, most of them were alcoholics. Nobody was really a drug addict, and it was like, you know, and I denied my cocaine use, really, and so I couldn't really relate to anybody there either, and I'm like, this isn't for me. I don't belong here, and nor was I ready to stop. I wasn't there for myself. I was there for my family. So I made it through the 30 days. I got the little 30-day chip to show everybody how good I was doing. I started the aftercare program, and about 2 weeks into the aftercare program, my neighbor across the street came knocking on the door at 10 o'clock with a joint, and boom, I was back, you know, I was back out there quickly, back to the cocaine and everything I was doing. And then several years back out there, in and out of my parents' house, in and out of my parents' house, you know, and every time I said, can I come back home, you know, I was homeless for a while too. I mean, I was living out on the street, sleeping in, you know, abandoned cars, because I didn't have a car at the time. And, you know, that's not how I was raised, but that's where the drugs took me, you know. And I just couldn't stop. And I just kept stuffing and self-medicating, and I was very self-destructive. And so anytime I said, can I come back home? And I got the, yeah, but, from my parents. Yeah, but. So I knew this time, you know, I was done running and stuff, and I came back, and I said, they were like, yeah, but. And I said, okay. So instead of going to meetings or getting myself in a program, I thought I was gonna do things my way. And again, I was just trying to get the focus off myself because I wasn't ready to quit. You know, I wasn't ready to stop doing what I was doing. I just knew I was trying to get a handle on things and maybe be a little more functional to be around for my son and, you know, function. Because when I was using, I was not functioning at all. I'd disappear. I was MIA all the time and, you know, binge for days on end. So I went and got a couple jobs. A part-time job and a full-time job, and I worked at a drugstore and a liquor store. It was a perfect setting for the drug addict and alcoholic. So I was working at Walgreens, and I was working part-time at a liquor store, cashiering or whatever, and I met this store manager that hired me. His name was Mr. Kramer, and prior to this, to back up a little bit, I was going to the Edge for some meetings in Chicago, and again, I was going to get people off my back, and there was a little stint where it was like, I walked in, and it was an AA meeting, and I seen all these happy people, and I was like, what the fuck are these people so happy about, you know? And then I remember seeing the steps and the traditions on the board, only I swear to God, at the time, for me, they were four times the size that they really are here. You know, like, I got to squint to read it right now. At the time, I was like, and the only word that stuck out was God. And I was like, hell no, this is not for me. Because I believed in that punishing God. And I thought of myself as a piece of shit, literally. You know, and, you know, I'm not a good person. Why is God going to want to help me? He's not going to want nothing to do with me, and I really didn't want nothing to do with him. Because at this time, I was blaming God for everything that happened in my life. Why me, God, poor me? Why me, God, poor me? You know? And so I didn't really connect to anybody. You know, I was the last one in, the first one out, and didn't really get any phone numbers. And finally my father said, you know, this isn't working. You need help if you're going to stay here. So he took me to this police assistant center where it was called St. Michael's House at the time. It was downtown Chicago by the United Center. And I met this man. His name was Jerry Bulger, and he was recovering, retired police officer, and he was a recovering alcoholic and addict. He was addicted to pills, and so he had many years of sobriety, and now he's counseling policemen and their families. And so I met him, and I remember going in there and just dumping everything and crying, and, you know, woe was me, and always on the pity pot. And I actually did get a lot out. I shared with Jerry. But I just wasn't ready at the time, and he started talking about halfway houses, and I was like, and I think at some point I ended up going back. You know, I got that 30-day chip for a little while, and then, you know, look, I got a chip. I'm doing good. And then I'd be right back out there again. As soon as the eyes were off me, I'd be right back out there again, you know. and because I was always doing it for somebody else. And so I ended up back out there for a few more years, and now I'm coming back, and I'm working at Walgreens, and I got this liquor store job, and now I got my own apartment, something that I always wanted. I wasn't involved in a living situation with a boyfriend, and so I had a studio apartment, and I was working all these hours and thinking I was going to be too tired to go use, and I still got the, you know, the itch here and there, you know, and the further I got into my addiction, it was like the lower the people I would hang out with, you know. I'm going to this guy's basement, the crack house, because now I'm smoking, and they don't have jobs. They're living in his mom's basement. You know, I have a job. You know, I have an apartment. I'm paying my bills. I'm not that bad. That's what I told myself. You know, and the reality of it was that I was just as bad as them. You know, I was just maybe kept it together for a little bit longer than they could, you know. So anyways, it really started getting way, way out of control. I was living in the studio apartment. Now I'm not even making it to work the days I'm supposed to be there, and I'm going and telling this Mr. Kramer who hired me. I got him wrapped on my finger. He's feeling sorry for me. I took advantage of the situation. I kind of took him for granted a lot because I knew he felt sorry for me, you know. And I would always cry on his shoulder like, you know, poor me, this is going on in my life, and this, and I never mentioned anything about drinking, and he used to always say to me, you just gotta lay off the sauce. Like, he knew. Why did I think he didn't know? But I really didn't think he knew. But people know. People know when we're using. We think they don't, but they do. You know, they know. So, anyways, this guy was willing to go to any length to help me get my life on track. He was a family man. He had a couple kids in high school and a kid in college, and he was just a do-gooder, you know. And he saw something in me. He saw potential in me. He saw something in me that I didn't see in myself, you know. And he wanted better for me than I wanted for myself. So he was helping me try and get my life on track, and he gave me chance after chance. And I would just not show up at work, and I wouldn't call. And next day I'd come back, and I'd have this big ego, like, "Aren't you happy to see me? Like, you know, you happy to see me?" And he just kept giving me chance after chance, and I know the other assistant managers were like always covering for me, like, you know, you gotta get, I know they were telling him, like, get rid of her, like, why is she still here, like, you know. So one day I went to work, I hadn't shown up for 2 days, I was at my apartment smoking with another guy from the crack house, and I remember after 2 days of not going to work, my doorbell rang, and I would never, ever answer the door, and I hit the intercom button, and it was my dad, and I buzzed him up for some odd reason. And I knew if he found this guy, he was going to kill him in my apartment. And so I told the guy, hide in the bathroom, it's my dad. I was like freaking out, panicking, like I was high. So my dad comes up to the door, and he's like, you know, what are you doing? What's going on? And I'm like, nothing. He's like, you know, your work called, you haven't been there 2 days. I'm like, I know, I haven't been feeling good. He's like, listen, he's like, I know what you're doing. I don't know why you're doing it, but I know what you're doing. He's like, and I'm done. And he started walking away, and it was a really long hallway where my apartment was to get back to the front. And I just remember crying and being like, Dad, Dad, I'm sorry, Dad, you know, and I was crying, and he never turned around. And I knew at that point, like, I gotta do something different. And at that time too, I was also suicidal, you know. I hated myself, but I wanted everybody else to like me, you know. And I used to walk around with this big smile on my face to make everybody think everything was okay. And on the inside, I was dying, you know. And I was manipulating situations. I was taking people for granted, my family. I was stealing money from them. You know, the people that I love most were hurt the most. And I didn't realize that until, you know, I had some clarity and a clear mind and I sobered up. And then I realized, you know, the damage that I'd done, but I didn't at the time. And part of me, I knew that they were going to be hurt, so when I was MIA, I would just stay awake. So I'm like, if they don't see what I'm doing, they can't worry about me. I'm not going to hurt them if they don't see what I'm doing, if they don't see me. In all reality, my mom's calling hospital. She hasn't heard from me in 4 or 5 days to see if any, or jails, hospitals, you know, like I put them through that. And I never realized that until, you know, my mind cleared up a little bit, and I realized the damage that I'd done. So anyways, I was suicidal at the time, and I just kept thinking, like, all I got to do is just turn on the gas and just on the stove and not wake up, you know, and it could all be over. And every time I had that thought, a picture of my son would come into my head. And I was back and forth in and out of my son's life, and this time when I had the studio apartment, he was probably like 13, 14, he was 15. And so he was coming over and hanging out and, you know, whatever. I had a relationship with him. I was just still not the authoritative figure, you know. I wasn't the mom, you know. I was the cool mom, you know, the friend. So every time I thought about killing myself, I had a picture of him would come into my head. And I just thought, like, I can't do it. I didn't have the courage, you know. Like, I can't leave him. And so I called up my dad, and I said, I'm ready to get help. So he picked me up. I went to his house, and he said, call Jerry Bulger at St. Michael's house. So I called up Jerry, and I was bawling because I was scared. Like, I knew, like, this was it. I'm the one that asked for help now. I got to follow through, you know. So I was bawling, and I said, you know, Jerry, it's Linda. I'm smoking crack every day, and I can't stop, and I need help. He's like, come down here tomorrow morning and see me. So I go see him in the morning, and he starts making all these phone calls, and he says, all right. He's like, I got an appointment for you at Lutheran General Hospital. He's like, you need to go. I got an assessment set up for you. You need to go over there. They're waiting for you. And I'm like, right now? You know, we all think that we got to get that one last one in. It's a Friday. Can we wait until Monday? Kind of works better for me. It's always about that one last one, you know? So he said, yeah, you got to go over there now. They're waiting for you. And I said, okay. So I remember going over there for the assessment and, you know, crying and I go for the assessment, and I walked right in, and I said, I need an inpatient. And I was ready. You know, I was just ready. I was so sick of living the way I was living. I was sick of feeling the way I was feeling. You know, I love getting high. I love the feeling of being high. I hated the consequences. I hated how I felt about myself. You know, the guilt, shame, and remorse. It was just killing me, you know. And I wasn't alive by any means, you know. So I said I was ready for an inpatient, and like I was gonna tell them already what I needed, the control freak that I was. And they said, well, we don't have an inpatient. We have a day program that you qualify for after I did the assessment. We have a day program, you're here all day, and we have a three-quarter house across the street. It's called DCA, Dempster Court Apartments, and it was run by a management company at the time. And so I said, okay. And they said, well, go home, pack a bag, and come back in the morning. And again, I was thinking, like, can I come back on Monday? And they were like, tomorrow morning, we have a place for you. And if you don't come back tomorrow morning, the bed will be gone. So I remember just, like, bawling. I was so scared. It was, like, the scariest thing I ever had to do because I knew this time, like, this has to be it. I never followed suggestions before. I picked and chose what I was going to do all the times before. You know, I was always doing it my way, never letting go of that control, never surrendering. And this time I was like, I'm out of options. You know, I obviously don't have the guts to kill myself. I don't have the courage. And, you know, I'm still here, you know, living this way. And I was just sick and tired of, you know, feeling miserable, you know. So, yeah, I was really scared, so I go home, and I pack my bag, and my mom says, well, let's go just drive by and see what kind of people are there and check it out. And I was like, okay. And like I told you, I was boy crazy since I was 8 years old, right? So we drive by the apartments, and I'm like, well, this doesn't look too bad, and it's daylight. And there's some guys outside playing basketball, and I see this guy, Mark, who is very, very good looking. I mean, God knows me and what it was going to take to get me there. That's all I can make of it today, because I was gung-ho as soon as I seen this guy. I was like, yep, I'm in. So I packed my bag the next morning. I went back to the treatment. I walk in the treatment center, and the counselors, you know, I introduced to my group, and the counselor said, and by the way, this is Mark, and he's going to take you around for the day, and lunch is across. And I'm like, yes! Yes, God, you know. So first day was great. The more time that went on there, just kept getting better and better. And, you know, this time when I got into that treatment center, I was introduced to a stranger, and the stranger was me. And I never realized how broken I was. I never realized I never had an identity for myself. I was very codependent. Any relationship I was ever in, you know, whatever he liked, I liked. If his favorite color was blue, my favorite color was blue, you know. I never had an identity. I didn't know anything about myself, nothing, you know. And I was really doom and gloom. You know, I just walked around, you know, always looking pissed off. I was very angry when I first came in. I was happy to be there, but I was very angry. I had a lot of anger. I was filled with anger and hatred. And, you know, underlying, the more time that went on, it was all the guilt, shame, and the remorse coming up that I had to deal with. You know, they say peel the layers of the onion, you know. And the anger and hatred was just surface, you know. So I go to the treatment center, and I'm there for the 30 days or whatever. And they tell me, you know, we have a meeting across the street, Coconuts, my very first CA meeting, Thursday night, 7:30. It was at Lutheran General Hospital at the time. And I remember walking into that meeting. There had to be about 100 people back then. And I felt immediately I belonged. I was home. I felt safe. I felt loved. You know, people at that meeting reached their hand out to me, and I grabbed on, and I've never let go since. My sobriety date is September 10th, 1999. And I have not made the choice to pick up a drink or a drug since that day. I was told also in this 30-day program that I needed to get a sponsor. So 3 weeks in, my one-on-one counselor was asking me, did you get a sponsor yet? And I was scoping out this lady at the meeting. She was always wearing the Serenity Prayer t-shirt, and she always had recovery clothes on, and she always seemed really nice and cheery. Her name was Ellen. And you know, and I had talked to her a couple times in the meeting. She was friendly to me, and I, you know, she welcomed me a few times. And so I said, after 3 weeks, I'm like, no, I don't have a sponsor yet. And they were hounding me and hounding me and hounding me. And he said, well, have you gotten any phone numbers yet, my counselor? And I was like, no, I haven't. And so the next week I come back, and he's like, you need to get phone numbers. So I said, okay. So there's this girl, Toby, and I asked her for a phone number because she just seemed really easygoing, and I wasn't intimidated by her. And I got a few phone numbers. So the next week, I'm back in the treatment, and my one-on-one my group session, and the counselor says, did you get any phone numbers? I'm like, yes, I did. And he's like, did you call the number? And I said, no, I haven't called. Did you get a sponsor? No, but I have somebody in mind. He's like, okay, well, I want you to go out to the payphone in the hallway right now and call the number you have. And I was like, oh, God. So I did. I had to go to the hallway, and I had to call this girl, Toby, and thank God she didn't answer, but I had to leave a message. And the next night, I was at Coconuts, and I walked up to Ellen, and the first time I walked up to her, as soon as she turned around, I walked away because I was very intimidated and nervous, and I think it was fear of rejection. Like, what if she says no? What if she doesn't like me, you know? Then what am I going to do, you know? And I really wanted, like, everybody to like me because I didn't like myself, you know? I hated myself. So I walked back up to her, and I said, would you be my sponsor? And she said, of course, you need to call me tomorrow. And I said, okay. So I went back to my group and told them very proudly that I had a sponsor, and I got a bunch of phone numbers. And from that point on, I started working the steps, you know? And I remember years ago when I was at the edge going to these meetings, and seeing the steps, and then seeing all the slogans around, you know, keep it simple, you know, one day at a time, let go of that God. Like, I hated all that. I hated it. And here they are, the slogans are back. But I'll tell you what, before I had working knowledge or understanding of the steps, because when you first come in, you're like, what? You know, They had to be explained thoroughly to me before I understood it. The slogans were the banisters to the steps, and I really held on to those slogans and lived by those slogans. And I was always living in yesterday or worried about tomorrow. You know, I was always feeling bad about something I did yesterday or having to explain tomorrow what I'm, and I never had a today. And so the one day at a time, you know, made it really simple. You know, you only have to stay sober for today, and only today counts. Yesterday's gone, can't do shit about it. Tomorrow's not promised to any of us. So that made it, for the first time out of all those years back and forth to meetings and treatments, I understood the one day at a time, and I grabbed that, you know, and I like ran with that. I was like, okay, for today. You know, and I was told by the sponsor, you know, pray and ask God for help every morning and thank him at night and start reading the big book. And after the 30 day was over in the treatment center, it was like your second stage or whatever you're going to, you know, level two or whatever they called it, transition period. So if I wanted to stay at the halfway house after the 30 days, I had to be working. Well, I had lost my job at Walgreens before I got in this treatment center. He finally said, you're done. And so I went back to my job and talked to Mr. Kramer, and I said, hey, I've been in a treatment center for 30 days. I said, I want to stay there a little bit longer, but I have to be working because there's a rent to pay and you have to be working while you're in the house, and is there any way that you'd be willing to give me my job back? And he's like, well, you look a lot better. He's like, you got some color back in your face. And I said, yeah, I'm doing good. And he's like, well, are you going to stay sober? And I said, yes. And because at that moment, yes, that was my choice. I'm loving this. I'm loving sobriety. I'm feeling better, you know. I'm happy, you know. I'm finding some happiness. So he said, okay. He's like, well, we'll see how it goes. I'll let you back on a 30-day trial basis. So he got me my job back after he fired me 30 days prior. And what a blessing, you know. So I stayed in the halfway house for 4.5 months. I did not want to leave there. I started getting involved in service work. Ellen said, she didn't say you need to do service. She said, come to the Tuesday night meeting, sit here and read the announcements. You're going to be here every week doing this. And I was like, okay. So I was introduced to service work 30 days sober, and I haven't stopped since. Pretty much have always had a service position of some sort. I started out GSRing, and then I started sharing meetings. And, you know, in the beginning, service was helping me, but in my first year or two of sobriety, you know, it was still really all about me. I had that ego. It was like I had to be center of attention because I still didn't have it in here, and I was still seeking outside myself. And, you know, I wanted to be front and center, so I was chairing all these meetings, and I was at the door greeting, and, you know, I was in the spotlight, but it helped me stay sober, you know. And I did what I was told to do, and we started working steps, you know. And when I got to that meeting, Coconuts, I remember everybody, you know, going around the room and telling their story with a happy ending. And I started believing, you know, I started hearing my story over and over and over with a happy ending. And I'm like, I believed that if these people could be happy, I could be happy too, you know. And that was my step too, you know, hope. They offered me hope. And I just started opening my ears and listening, and I had this willingness, and I started becoming honest. And you know, step three, made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. You know, I didn't really struggle too much with God anymore. I was doing a general prayer like, God, please help me stay clean and sober in the morning, and thanking him at night like I was told to do. I started having a little bit of a connection, but, you know, nothing like I have, you know, nothing to what it's grown to be today. But I didn't hate God anymore. I didn't blame God anymore because I was taught to take responsibility for myself, you know, and stop blaming others. You're not the victim. That was a hard thing to hear in the beginning. A lot of my own truths were very hard to hear in the beginning, but very necessary for me to hear them and for those things to be brought out to my attention, or else I wouldn't have grown to be the person I am today. Because I hid behind my lies for many, many years and denied my own truth for many, many years and pointed the finger out that way and not in here, you know. So the third step, I was starting to get attracted to these people that had the spirituality, you know, these women that I met that were talking about God this and God that, and they just had this peace and calmness to them, and I was super attracted to that, and I wanted to be around those people more, you know, and I wanted that for myself, and the only way to get it was, you know, to hang around those kind of people. And I kept going over the third step, like reading it, and I was in the little red book, the 12 and 12, you know, the big book, and trying to understand it because I wanted it so desperately, you know. And I was told by somebody that had a lot of time at the time, when I asked about the third step, like, can you explain this to me? He said, listen, the third step's nothing. It's not up here. It's in here. And so the more I kept praying, one day the desire and compulsion to use left me. And I believed at that point that God was going to help me if I asked for help. Before that, I didn't feel worthy and deserving of God's help. I didn't feel worthy deserving of anybody's help, you know. But when once that desire and compulsion left me, I finally felt like, you know, I had an in with God, you know. I knew, like, he was listening to me and he was there for me and I could count on him. So a couple years sober, I'm still chasing the guys, you know, in and out of all these relationships, very dysfunctional because I was still unhealthy. And I'll tell you what, there were a couple of things I didn't agree with when I first came in the program this time. And one of them was, they'd say, oh, you have a resentment toward her? Pray for her. And I was like, pray for her? Why would I want to pray for somebody I don't like? You know, or don't get involved in a relationship for the first 12 months. Well, I didn't know how to do that, honestly, so... that was one suggestion I found out the hard way of why they say that. And the other thing that they had said was, can't think about it right now. I can't remember. But anyways, women's meetings. You should be going to women's meetings. I'm like, why would I want to do that? You know, because I still had to have all the attention, you know, and I was always seeking outside myself. And if the guys gave me attention, you know, I must be okay. So I did end up started to go to women's meetings because I was told that I had to be attending women's meetings. And I'll tell you what, the most healing I've done is at the women's meetings. And I've learned to stick with the women, and honestly, I've done so much healing and growing, and I needed women in my life to be examples for me, you know, how to be a good daughter, how to be a good mother, you know, how to be a good person, how to be ladylike. I was not ladylike when I first came in. I had a truck driver mouth. I was always dressed in all black, although I have black on tonight. It is a dress. It is a dress. I would never be caught dead in a dress before. So... I stayed in the halfway house for 4.5 months. I moved out of there. I went to live at my parents' house and stayed there for about a year to, like, save up money and get on my own. So 2 years sober, I had my own apartment, and my son was 16 when I got sober, and right out the gate, I made my first amends to him, and he's like, Mom, and I was crying, of course, and apologizing because I had a lot of guilt where my son's concerned for not being the mother that I wanted to be and that he deserved. I felt like I sold them short for a lot of years, and I still struggle with that at times, but I try not to focus on the past. I focus on the relationship that I have with him today and the mom I am to him today. And we are like this today. But when I made my amends to him, he said, Mom, I know that wasn't you. You know, he was just very forgiving, and you know, everybody that I made amends to forgave me. I had a hard time forgiving myself, you know, because we like to beat ourselves up. We're very good at doing that, you know. So 2 years sober, I got my first apartment, and my son was living with me, and he was back and forth, getting ready to go to college and stuff, and, you know, I was living the dream. I was doing really good. Still kind of dabbling in those unhealthy relationships, but trying to find my way. And so I had changed sponsors at the time, and I met this girl, Kathy, way back when I was in the halfway house, and she had a year more than I had. So when I was brand new, she was a year sober. She was a heroin addict, and she was sponsoring the girl that was my roommate at the time. And I remember sitting in a meeting with her. She came to our house and did a meeting and gave a lead, and I was like, wow. Like, she had really great sobriety for a year. Like, just the way she talked and everything, I was very attracted to that. So after a couple years of sobriety, I asked her to sponsor me. And honestly, she helped me be the woman I am today. Kathy was never afraid to tell me the truth, the brutal, honest truth that I never wanted to hear. I can't tell you how many times I picked her phone to call her and I'd end up crying because of how she was telling me, you know, pointing stuff out, you know, my shit and what I'm doing wrong and my patterns and my behaviors. And, you know, I'm trying to talk about other people and she's putting it back on me. And I hang up the phone crying and I was like, I'm never calling her again. You know, like, I was so upset. I was like, I'm never calling her again. And the next day, you know, I knew what she was telling me the truth. I knew that those were my truths that I needed to hear. And the next day I called her again, you know, and we did a lot of work together. She became my best friend. So I changed sponsors again at that point. But she's back my sponsor today for a temporary situation. But she's honestly my rock. And I'm very, extremely, extremely grateful for her and how she's helped me grow to be the woman that I am today. And she introduced me to God. And I mean, really pushed me into falling in love with God. Because I remember her saying to me one time, you know what your problem is? You need to quit worrying about falling in love with this guy and that guy and this guy. You need to fall in love with God. And I was like it hit me like a ton of bricks. So I was like, okay, well, how do I do that? How do I fall in love with God, you know? So she said, well, you know how when you and your boyfriend, you have a boyfriend, you got a God song, you need to find, you know, you have a song, love song, you need to find a God song. It's yours and God's song. You need to take walks, find a God spot, you know. Sit at home, light some candles, invite God in the room, talk to God, you know, and really fall in love with God. And I was like, okay. And she's like, you need to start spending time by yourself and being alone. And you need to talk to God more. And she's like, when you're home alone, instead of picking up the phone and calling, you know, so-and-so, or, you know, if I wasn't in a relationship, my best friend was a guy, instead of, because it was the attention I had to have, you know, instead of picking up the phone and calling somebody, you just sit and be quiet, you know, and spend time alone. And so I learned how to do all that, and one day I'm driving my car, and, you know, I'm frantically searching for the God song, because it was kind of like what I was told to do, and it was the way to find God, and one way of finding God. And you know, it would have been like a week past, and I was just really trying to like find this God song, and I'm changing the radio station, listening to all these songs. And after about a week, I was like, I kind of was like letting it go a little bit, like, okay, I'm just not going to find a God song. And I'm driving down the street one day, and Lifehouse, Hanging by a Moment, comes on. And I wasn't, you know, I just literally was listening to the words of the song, and tears just started streaming down my face. And I related that. What the lines in the song were, was me and God, you know, and that's my God song. It still is today. I have a few, but, and it really helped me to connect to God, you know. I had a God place along a river I'd go. I wrote 4 steps there. I've just gone there just to have quiet time sometimes, coffee, cold, rain, snow, whatever. I've been there. So when I was 2 years sober, my father had cancer. He told us he had cancer, and but it was he was going to be going for treatments and stuff. And I was like, okay. So I rallied up, you know, I rallied up because we suit up and we show up, and we're, you know, we're there for our families now that we're sober, you know, and we could be there. So I was going to all the doctor's appointments and treatments, and I was always there, and couldn't, you know, had coffee time with my dad, and I was. you know, always really connected to my dad, and my dad was very, very proud of me. And he couldn't be happier than I was sober. You know, he was just ecstatic, over the top. And so he suffered from cancer for about 2 years, and after 2.5 years, he decided to go in hospice, that he was gonna, he was tired of fighting, you know, and he was ready to give up, and he was just over it. And he wasn't really getting any better. He had lung cancer. So I remember my girlfriend, Kathy, her son was being christened, and the day, this was the day after my dad decided to go into hospice. So I'm at this church, and I'm with this other girlfriend of mine, and we're at this christening, and I just remember not feeling hopeful anymore once my dad decided to, like, give up. I'm like, this, you know, this is it, you know, and I was pretty crushed about it. So I, me and my girlfriend left the church a little bit early, and we went to Kathy's house to start setting up the food for people. And my girlfriend was in the house, and I went on the back porch, and it was just me and her at the time, and everybody else was coming behind us a little bit later. And I remember sitting out on our porch, lived in Lakeville. I had a beautiful yard, and it was just so very peaceful out there. And it was a sunny day, and I remember sitting out there, and I was just thinking about, you know, my dad making this decision to go into hospice and how heartbroken I was, and I was just super sad, you know. And out of nowhere, a butterfly, a monarch butterfly, came and landed on my shirt, like right here. And it literally sat there. It seemed like forever, but I'm sure it wasn't forever. And immediately when that butterfly landed on me, and I just looked down, and it was sitting there for maybe a minute, I don't know, I was overcome with this feeling of peace and like a warmth that I have never experienced before in my whole entire life. And I know that that was God. You know, I know that was God filling me with the peace that I needed to get through the next situation. And so the hospice nurse came in and said, it's going to be about 2 weeks before, you know, they usually narrow it down. It's going to be about 2 weeks. So we put a hospital bed in my mom's living room, in their living room. And I told my work, my job at the time, now, you know, I was promoted up into manager, and I was, I got up to store manager from Mr. Kramer, who kept promoting me and promoting me and promoting me through the years. So I said, I need a couple weeks off of work. You know, they knew the situation. They said, take whatever you need. And I left my apartment. I moved into my parents' house, and I stayed on the couch next to the hospital bed with my dad, and helped my mom take care of him. My son was coming home from college, and we were all there. And I remember within this 2 week period that I was terrified of leaving the house, because my desire and what I really wanted was to be holding my dad's hand and telling him that I loved him when he passed away so badly. And I didn't want to miss the opportunity. And so I was terrified to leave the house for the 2 weeks. But after a couple days, you know, the sponsor I had at the time was like, listen, you have to still go to meetings. You're going through something. You still have to show up. You got to go take care of yourself still, you know. So, and I remember just at the time, like, I was just so devastated and so crushed that everybody in the program was there for me, you know. And I just remember picking up the phone and calling people, and all I was able to do was just cry. And they were all on the other end like, it's okay, you know, we're here for you. And I kept saying to God, you know, please help me to accept whatever happens as the way is exactly the way it's supposed to happen, in the moment. But know that I really want to be holding my dad's hand and tell him that I love him when he passes away. So I was going to my meetings, doing whatever I had to do. I was doing what I was told to do, you know, there for my dad, taking care of. And the morning that he passed away, I was there holding his hand, telling him that I loved him. And I knew right then and there, I felt peace for a couple different reasons. One, I don't have to watch my dad wilt away anymore, because it was horrifying. And two, I had this, almost like this excitement or this joy that God thought I was strong enough to handle that situation and put me exactly where I wanted to be. He saw that in me. And it just brought me so much joy, you know. So the wake and funeral and stuff, and I had my 4-year coin, and I said to the funeral director, you know, can you just put this in with my dad? And it time I wasn't, you know, I didn't care. I just wanted in with them. I didn't want to know anything, you know, when I was talking to some family members or whatever. And my dad was in a nice suit, and he had a couple, you know, pockets on his jacket and stuff. And so later on, the director came over to me and said, the only pocket that your dad had was on his shirt next to his chest. These were just flaps. The jacket wasn't pockets. So that's where my coin was, right by his heart. And again, thank you, God. You know, thank you, God, for allowing me to be sober and here in the moment with my family. And, you know, and I owe this all to you people. Cocaine Anonymous saved my life. The Big Book, Alcoholics Anonymous, changed my life, you know, and I am honestly forever grateful. You know, the meetings on my medicine, I learned a bunch of stuff. Trying to watch the time. You know, I'm human. I'm not perfect. I'm not a saint. I could be judgmental. Ask my husband. He hears stuff at home sometimes that I wouldn't talk about anywhere else. But for the most part, you know what? I have compassion and empathy for people. I'm a good person. I try and do the next right thing. I show up for people. You know, I sponsor women. Gina, who's here tonight, who always shows up for me. And, you know, she's a pillar of strength for me. You know, I know that I help her, and she tells me all the time that, you know, that I help her. But honestly, we all have struggles in sobriety, and I have watched her have some really hardcore losses and struggles. And I draw strength from her, and, you know, on a daily basis. Women like her give me the strength to continue on, you know, and she's a rock of mine, too. She's a sponsee, but she's my rock, and I'm her rock, and, you know, me and her are, we're all good, you know. We've been together a long time, and I love that I have her in my life. And I have an army of women, you know. I have an army of women that will just be there and drop a hat for me, and I would do the same for them. I, you know, can make better choices today as a result of this program, you know. Trust God to clean house and help others, you know. That's what I learned to do, you know. And to me, the magic to this program is in the steps, you know. I work the steps, the better, you know, the more I work the steps, the better I get in here, the better I get in here, the better everything out here gets, you know. And if you're brand new and you think you don't have anything grateful to be grateful for, yet, you know, just be grateful you're sitting in the room, you know, with us, like-minded people, you know, like Brian Tenenbaum always says, my promoter. I'm on a convention committee, and I'm the co-chair this year, and for the last 4-5 years, I've been the chair and all kinds of stuff, and keep getting roped right back in, but I love it. I love convention committee. I've had several positions, like I said, H&I and service positions, but we just had our convention last weekend, and, you know, I only told a few people that I was speaking because I'm not, I don't know, I just don't like to tell a lot of people, like, promote myself, like, hey, I'm speaking, come on out. I don't know, it's a good thing or a bad thing, but it's kind of how I am sometimes. I just try and be humble, you know, and I had told a few people, and I got to the convention. I told one of my best friends, this guy Bobby, that I was speaking, and next thing you know, he tells his sponsor, Brian, and Brian's like, you gotta tell people, they gotta show up. I'm like, I've told some people, and he's like, I said, I'll tell you what, you can be my promoter, and you can tell people. So I call him my promoter now. I mean, another thing, if you're brand new, expect miracles. You know, there's a lot of blessings in my life today, and like I said, I've had ups and downs over the last 18 years. My son's now 34, and we're tight as can be, best friends. I learned how to be his mother, and, you know, we have a mutual respect. I look up to him, and he looks up to me. It's kind of crazy, they have a Airbnb in Costa Rica, so I'm fortunate enough to be able to go there a couple times a year. And this January, my husband and I went for we got there together, and after a week, my husband left, and He's in a beach town, so it's up on a mountain, and in the morning, I'm going out to 7 o'clock in the morning, I got my meditation, my head buds, I got my, you know, my big book with me, and I've been going there. He's been there 2 years now, so the first couple times I went, I met this girl, Amy, and they said, oh, you got to meet this girl, Amy, she's our friend, she's sober too, and I was like, awesome. So I met this girl, Amy, and she says, oh, yeah, it's a big AA town, we have meetings here. I'm like, really? So she took me to a meeting, AA meeting, and it's a Pacific group down there. It's 10 minutes from where my son lives, and every morning they have a 10 a.m. breakfast meeting. People from the States with many years of sobriety are at this meeting, and it's amazing, you know. It's like I have another fellowship when I go, you know. And I was lucky enough to be able to stay for a month this time when I went in January. I kind of got my zen on while I was there, but I also was involved in a motor scooter accident. And, of course, right after my husband left, I was decided to be a little crazy. But anyways, I said, yeah, I want to learn how to ride a scooter so I can get to the meetings or go to the beach or whatever I want to do, right? So my son has two scooters, and he got on one. He showed me what to do. I'm like, okay, I got it. And he's like, if anything... You know, if you're not sure, you think you're going too fast, just let go of the handle. That's the gas. I'm like, okay. He's like, it'll just be like letting go of the gas pedal. The thing will slow down. I'm like, okay. So I got a helmet on because it's a helmet law, thank God. And he pulls out, and I pull out behind him, only I'm not in the right lane. I'm in the opposite lane. They drive the same way, but I end up in the opposite lane because a scooter is weird to turn, and I just was already nervous. And I panicked, and I realized I'm going in the oncoming traffic, and usually people drive crazy there. I mean, they drive crazy. And thank God this cab was coming. I was going head-on to this taxi cab, and he was crawling looking for people to pick up, thank God. And when I realized, like, I was just so panicked, I didn't know what to do. So on a steering wheel, I would have tightened up, and I tightened up on the handlebars, and I hit the throttle, and I went 30 miles an hour into this cab. On the hood, I landed, and on the ground. And I hear my son, Mom, Mom, oh, my God. And the first thing I think about was, like, you're fine. Get up. Dust your knees off. You can, you know, you're fine. And I was, luckily, I was able to get up. And I know I screwed up my arm, and I was pretty banged up, and went to emergency room, and they hooked me up with, like, an IV bag with some fluids because my body was definitely in shock. I had very low blood pressure, and they gave me some ibuprofen. I was just kind of banged up, you know. My arm's kind of still screwed up. I'm sure I'll be in physical therapy in a couple weeks. I just had an MRI this morning, but I'm very lucky, you know. So I laid around for a couple days. I was trying to get better, and once I started getting up and moving around, and my son Dan's like, so are you feeling better? And I'm like, uh-huh, feeling a lot better. He's like, okay, you are banned from anything motorized, including power tools. And I was like, okay. And I think I was able to use the blender with supervision. But, yeah, I was a little klutzy. But I'm really blessed, you know. I got married, my wonderful husband, Tom, who's... I'm his biggest fan, and he's my biggest fan. I finally have found an unconditional love and a mutual respect. We have an amazing relationship and a marriage, and I love him with all my heart. I mean, I feel very lucky and very blessed to have Tom in my life. And we hold each other up, you know what I'm saying? We're just very in tune with each other, and it's just so easy, you know. It's not something that we really have to work with. We just click, we just mesh, you know. And he knows, you know, emotionally when I'm not, you know, in a good place, and I know when he's not. We just kind of like hold each other up, you know. speak up. I'm going to wrap it up. Hey, is that better? Anyways, like I said, I'm extremely grateful to be here clean and sober. Without CA and you people, I would not have the life I live today. I have the power to help others today, which is a gift. I love working with new people. I love working with people. I love giving it away. I've learned to live in the present moment, because that's really all that counts, is the moment. And for the most part, I'm very positive, upbeat. I love people. And I love helping others. You know, I'm there for my family today. I'm there for my friends. I've worked very hard on self-worth, self-love, self-care, and self-respect. And it took me many, many, many years to get to where I'm at, and I'm still not done. But I know I've come a long way, and I'm grateful to all the people in my life for that help. I do go to therapy. I sought outside help probably. I've been seeing the same lady for 10 years, and sometimes I see her once a week if things are going on in my life. Sometimes it's every other week. Sometimes it's once a month. It depends, you know, what's going on. But I have not wanted to stop seeing her. She's a rock of mine, and she really keeps me grounded. And I just keep, like I said, the layers. I just keep peeling and peeling and peeling because there's always something that's coming up, you know. And sometimes I, you know, I need extra help, you know, to recognize and be aware, you know. And I guess that's it. I wanted to close with, by the way, I brought this book up here, The Language of Letting Go. It's a meditation book by Melody Beattie. She does the Codependent No More book. And women and men, I mean, I think this is an amazing meditation book. It's all about nurturing and self-care and love and healing. So what I wanted to read out of it was, it's not today's, I think it's February 4th. But I love what it says. It says, enjoying recovery. What a journey. This process of growth and change takes us along an ever-changing road. Sometimes the way is hard and steep. Sometimes we climb mountains. Sometimes we slide down the other side on a toboggan. Sometimes we rest. Sometimes we search through the darkness. Sometimes we're blinded by the sunlight. At times, many may walk with us on the road. Sometimes we feel nearly alone. Ever changing, always interesting, always leading. Someplace better, someplace good. What a journey. Thank you guys for being here.